Good afternoon. I'll call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order and note that we have a quorum present. Do I have someone that would make a motion to approve the previous meeting's minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Igo. Moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Members, we have three bills on the agenda today. The first bill is House File 3403, Emergency Rental Assistance. Folks will remember we did hold a hearing on this bill the first week of session, and Representative Kozlowski is back with this bill in a new form. And so, Representative Kozlowski, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Chair Howard, I would like to move the bill.
Vice Chair Kozlowski moves that this bill be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. We plan to vote and re-refer this bill out. Vice Chair, you have the DE2 amendment. Would you briefly describe the amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. The DE2 amendment is just looking to get this bill into the shape to move this critical emergency assistance forward. It incorporates several technical changes, such as eligibility around prioritizing households with a minor child, as well as clarify some timing mechanisms, and then the funding source, which is the reason why we're back, that conversation around finding a budget-neutral solution.
Any discussion to the DE2? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 is adopted. Representative Kozlowski, to your bill as amended.
Great. Good afternoon, members, and to the many Minnesotans gathered here with us on Homeless Day on the Hill, joining myself and Representative Egbadje again for the real and urgent experiences that our neighbors are enduring. This bill before you provides $40 million in emergency rental assistance that, again, will be delivered through our counties and tribal nations. And quite simply, it's a lifeline, a lifeboat to the Minnesotans who urgently need this. We introduced this proposal on the very first day of the 2026 Housing Committee. And just moments ago, the Senate has just passed this actually off of the House of their floor in being able to bring forward a budget-neutral solution. We've received the budget forecast and worked with many stakeholders and partners in order to bring this forward and meet the moment. The funding source of the remaining dollars from the Tyler settlement that you might remember from the 2024 session and what Representative Egbadje will speak to more really comes from the fighting spirit of Mrs. Tyler. Ms. Tyler, and the deadline to file for those settlement claims that we passed in that session to fight back against housing injustice. Those dollars remain in the account from the claims that have not come forward or that have passed, and the ones that remain there would otherwise just default back to the general fund. So this bill is directing those dollars to where they're most needed, and that's keeping Minnesotans housed. And as we've said over and over again, and organizations like United Way and Homeline are reporting a 60 to 80% increase in calls from tenants who cannot pay their rent and seeking emergency assistance. Counties have already exhausted their next quarter rental assistance, and eviction filings are expected to spike again this week, and we know April rent is already looming. Members, we have seen the highest number of evictions filings in state history in 2025, and if we fail to act quickly to take meaningful action against especially the instability crashing down on us from the federal government, we will break that record again in the worst way. So suffice it to say, families are being squeezed, but we have the tools and we could have the courage and the political fortitude to take action now with proven community-driven solutions to keep and stabilize kids, families, seniors, and keep them housed. I lastly want to, before I turn it over to Rep. Egbadje to share a few remarks, it is Homeless Day on the Hill, and I've had the honor to present bills every single year in my 4 years at the Capitol. And that matters to me because in 2024 and 2025, we've lost over 400 Minnesotans that we know of to housing instability. Minnesotans like Allen in my community in St. Louis County, where over a third of those numbers come from. These aren't just numbers and statistics. These are neighbors and family members who are working extremely hard like Allen, who's a young person who was found on the lake walk with a sleeping bag over him. He's getting a job. He is so close to getting a house, and we don't even know what the cause of his death was. People like my mom in my first term, Gwenny, she was working a job thanks to the city working program at the library. She succumbed because of homelessness and didn't have a place to stay. And in my second term, my brother, Stephen, he wasn't even 38 years old. He was working at Walmart, and he was couch surfing, and he died to homelessness. And so I'm here because I don't want another Minnesotan to go to that, and we can prevent these evictions right here and right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Representative Kozlowski, for bringing this forward and for the updates in the D2 amendment. We have heard, when we previously heard a version of this bill, that why does the state need to step up because other neighbors are doing what they can for their own neighbors. And that is true, but we know that those funds are quickly drying up. Even in my own neighborhood, we have been fortunate enough to raise more than $200,000, and we've helped more than 80 families. But again, across the city and the state, that story unfolds over and over again, where every organization, though they had success in January and some success in February, is not sure that they will have that same success in March. People have been resourceful. It is time for the state to step up and to help the people as well. We need the state to help up, to step up to make sure that people can make the rent, because that has been an acute concern for residents of Minnesota, particularly in these ensuing months. And we believe that no one should have to be out on the street or in the cold because they lost their job or were fearful of going to work through no fault of their own. And this is our chance to show that we take care of everyone in Minnesota by ensuring that they can pay their rent and that they have a safe place to stay. As Representative Kozlowski talked about, I would also like to point out that the method we use to pay for this rental assistance are dollars that won't have an impact on the general fund because they are from the settlement related to a tax forfeiture lawsuit that was also related to housing. Ms. Geraldine Tyler, she had sued Hennepin County, and the Minnesota Supreme Court agreed with her that the county took excess from her property sale. So the settlement dollars that the state put in, we've been able to use those dollars to make sure that people in her similar situation are made whole. And so the remainder of those funds should be used to address additional housing needs like rental assistance to make sure more people can stay in their homes, get back on their feet, and contribute to the economy. Additionally, as we've said before, these funds are going to go through trusted and vetted channels. And in all those cases, they will go directly to the landlords to ensure that this is going to make landlords whole and ensure that renters can stay in their homes. And with that, turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bajaj. We have one testifier that signed up who's testifying virtually, Commissioner Annie Harala. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and leaders of this committee, and thank you so much to the authors of this bill and those that are a part of this conversation. Appreciate the opportunity today to testify on House File 3403. I represent Duluth within St. Louis County, a region that is incredibly diverse in nature. My district includes tightly urban neighborhoods alongside working with my colleagues that have deeply rural communities. And across that entire landscape, every community is struggling with housing supports right now. We, in every single district with my six colleagues and I, we are hearing this from our neighbors over and over again. And I've seen again and again that when people fall on hard times, neighbors do step up for neighbors. But today, the need is growing faster than any local communities can carry alone. GoFundMes only go so far when everyone is really struggling to meet their bills right now with this economy. In St. Louis County, our emergency housing assistance funds have run out. They'll run out in the next couple of days. We have just over, and with only a little bit left, and we don't have a new allocation until July, and we don't have the room within our budget to add to this. And so that leaves us a 4-month stretch where families facing eviction, job disruption, and crisis have absolutely nowhere to turn. And many don't even have neighbors that they could just turn to lend them a little bit of money. In fact, today I got a message from someone asking to pitch in for $350 to make sure that a mom could keep her single mom could keep her apartment, and she could keep her three sons in our local high school. So our main prevention tool as a county is the PHPAP funding. It's been cut dramatically. In fact, over the last two-year cycle, our county received $2.7 million. But in the current two-year cycle, that dropped to just over $800,000. So even as this need continues to grow, we've seen a backslide in that investment in what we already have. And we know it takes about $2,000 on average to stabilize a household and prevent homelessness. These are modest investments that keep families housed and communities stable. And I would say $2,000 versus the lifelong changes that we see from people struggling through homelessness is the right investment to make right now. We can't absorb this gap locally. Counties are facing compounding pressures from our federal government, from state cuts, paired with increasing requirements and cost shifts back to us. So we can't continue to pass those costs on to property taxpayers who are already seeing these rising housing costs. Simply put, we can't do this alone and we need you. So we see these consequences every single day, walking into every frontline provider of our county or our staff being out within our communities or the providers that provide for us. And in fact, this winter, more than 600 people have stayed in our warming center just in Duluth. And we've had full shelters in north and south, having to turn away folks in the northern half of our county and in the southern half. So this gives communities a response right now. And we can use systems that are already in place and to help people before the housing crisis grows even further. Housing stability is a foundation that everything else stands on. And right now, this bill is how we keep that foundation strong for thousands of Minnesotans. I would also say, as a county that fought hard for the dollars for Tyler and that settlement, what a great place to pull from, a place that we ensured that you were not putting that burden on counties to have to cover the cost of that state need. This is the perfect spot. And so appreciate the authors for finding that. And I thank you for your consideration, and I yield my remarks.
Thank you. Is there anyone in attendance here that would like to testify? Seeing none, we can move to member discussion. Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Chair Howard. So I think this bill is great. I thought it was a great bill when we first heard it. I still do today. We know the best way to end homelessness is to prevent it in the first place. Prevention is going to save money on the whole system. It's going to have better outcomes for the individuals than, you know, when you're handling it upstream than if you're working on the problem downstream after it's already occurred. As a Coon Rapids City Council member, I witnessed some unfortunate things. I witnessed council members voicing concerns over homeless people in the city, voicing concerns over, you know, items in the woods or people on a corner asking for money, yet they also voted no on homeless shelters that would house those folks. So they voted no on a hotel conversion, a hotel that wasn't doing well, was going to potentially be able to be sold to Stepping Stone and be turned into a shelter. It was voted down by the council. They voted no on a commercial property being able to be changed into zoning for multifamily for a shelter. They voted no on that. So we can't have it both ways. We have to tackle this issue, and the best way is to prevent the problem in the first place. As a teacher, I also saw firsthand the additional struggles that students who were coping with homelessness faced. And they also had outcomes that would have been better if the homelessness was prevented in the first place. So it's better for our kids, it's better for our community, it's better for all of the individuals themselves. And so I support your bill, and Chair Howard, I would like to request a roll call vote on the bill. Thank you.
We'll have a roll call on the bill. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you. Do we have targets?
Representative Nash, I'm not aware of targets. This bill is budget neutral, though, which was the main request that you folks had when we heard the bill on the first day of session.
Well, Mr. Chair, once again, I just don't see it. I mean, the testifier that we just heard from said we don't have room in our budget. There's no such thing as budget neutrality. So I do not see this as something that we need to begin moving forward on before we even have a firm picture on where we are as a committee, on our spending priorities as a committee, if we spend anything as a committee. So I'm a no, and I'm happy to go on record as voting no.
Just to correct the record, it is budget neutral. This would not have an impact on the general fund, which again was the main force of the argument from your side on the first day of session. We found a way to use this Tyler settlement. We moved a bill that was budget neutral out of this committee on a bipartisan basis earlier this year. This takes the exact same form.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Igbaje.
Also, as one of the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, we are expecting to see bills from a variety of committees to be able to vet them to ensure that they meet with our budget outlooks. As we've seen the forecast a couple weeks ago, we do have a short-term, nice-looking picture. Obviously, we have to be considerate of issues that may be coming down the long term, but we do know that we're in a situation that we will have to do something to address the needs of Minnesotans.
Representative Mamani Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair, and the committee. And thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. And as we discussed in the first time around, we've all have seen and have heard the testimonies of many of us, many of our community members, and the impact that this is, this will alleviate if we pass this bill. As an immigrant legislator, once again, I have seen firsthand how, this work impacts individuals, especially in my community. In the wealthiest nation in the world, right? Especially here in Minnesota, no family should lose their home because, one medical bill, one car repair, or one missed paycheck. And we are seeing that, and that's the impact of, ICE and Metro Surge. And so this bill is not just, we started off with $50 million, we went down to $40 million. It's not just an emergency rental assistance bill. It's an economic stabilizer for our state. When we allow evictions to happen, the cost multiplies. Counties spend more on shelters, schools observe instability, employers lose workers, healthcare systems, right? Healthcare systems shoulders the preventable crisis. So eviction is expensive. So if we can keep folks housed, that is the better option here. But when we step into this early, in it early, one-time rental assistance, we will stop the spiral before it begins. We keep parents working, we keep children in their schools, we keep families rooted in their community, from Brooklyn Park all the way to rural towns in this state. I just want to quickly just thank all the advocacy groups who've been able to be here and really champion this cause. You guys are the real MVPs. In my specific district, I have organizations who've literally looked at every penny under the rug so that they can help families. One of them is ACER and the work that they've been doing. They are running out of the very limited funding that they've had. And so this is another way of saying we have your back. The state has your back. And for those concerned about accountability, for those who talk about, well, this, it might create more fraud, well, there's safeguards in place. They have both talked about it. The representatives up there have talked about it. In place to prevent fraud and ensure responsible distribution through trusted community partners. As we've heard earlier, this bill already has passed the Senate floor. And it's time for the House to follow suit. It's time for us to do the right thing. It's time for us to stop playing politics with people's lives and do the right thing and pass this bill. Emergency rental assistance is not just a handout. It's a bridge. It's a bridge for many families, a bridge that protects families, stabilizes our workforce, and strengthens our economy. This is the Minnesota way that we all love. I urge your support for this bill. Thank you so much.
Representative Danta.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Kozlowski, question I've got is will illegals be able to partake in of this rental assistance as well?
Chair Howard.
Representative Kozlowski.
Vice Chair Dotseth, I'm not sure what you mean by an illegal.
Representative Dotseth.
would be the best way to phrase it, maybe just undocumented people that are here?
Representative Kozlowski.
Chair Howard and Vice Chair Dotseth. As you know, as a Native American person, I believe that nobody is illegal on stolen land with stolen labor. But what this bill does is, if you look at the language, as long as you're a Minnesota resident, this bill will support you. But you have to have Minnesota residency. And I will add for a note that many folks who are seeking rental assistance, many of the folks that have been harmed and are bearing the most brunt by the impacts coming down from the federal government, whether that's SNAP cuts, whether that's health cuts that are impacting us in greater Minnesota, our rural access clinics that are making cuts to our EMS services, tariffs that are jacking up costs, estimated $1,000 to $2,000 impacting Minnesota families, those are all of our neighbors, no matter your status. For some folks, they are also being targeted. Status, legal status, includes a wide swath of folks. Asylum seekers, TPS seekers, like our Venezuelan community members, our Haitian communities who were here, who go through the right process and who are still racially profiled, who are on a whim, suddenly by President Trump, declared no longer eligible to be here, even though they have gone through all the legal status processes. And so this bill is a bill for all Minnesotans.
Representative Dotseth.
So just a follow-up. So my
No clapping, please.
As long as they're residents of Minnesota, not necessarily illegals, but as long as they're residents of Minnesota, they'd actually be able to partake in this. Follow-up question would be, is what assurance do we have that this isn't just one-time money, that this doesn't come back a year from now and looking for additional funding for this?
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And again, nobody is illegal. That term is very dehumanizing. But to the second question about how do we ensure that these funds are just one-time funds, well, it's baked into the funding source this time. And that is a question that you had asked last time, and I appreciate. I think I'll say two things quick, and if you have anything you'd like to add, I'll say that these one-time dollars are tied to the Tyler Settlement Funds, and so those are dollar-limited dollars, funds that are in that account right now. So once those are expended, that would no longer be cost budget neutral. But I'll also say that as long as we continue to have homelessness in Minnesota, we know that the gaping hole is $350 million already. And then the latest survey from the University of Minnesota put out that Minnesotans were already $50 million. Most are 1 or 2 months behind on rent. And then with the latest federal impacts that we've seen another $50 million on top of that. We have a federal government that's spending $38 billion on detention centers, as well as rounding up our neighbors, as well as unhoused relatives across the country. And I think we could all be putting our focus on making sure that those dollars are doing right by the taxpayers here in Minnesota and being put to use for solving the homelessness crisis. $38 billion could actually solve housing for every single person in the U.S., as well as solve our food insecurity as well.
Anything further?
Representative Kozlowski, I look forward to working with you as this moves forward.
Co-Chair Igo.
Thank you, Co-Chair Howard. And I do appreciate the proposal we have in front of us today. Prior to the conversation we had on our first committee hearing, and this is an issue that you have bipartisan support on, and I do understand the benefits of FHPAP. I had a couple concerns, and I didn't get full answers before we got here today, so I was working and trying to get there. I had heard over the interim that there could be future cases tied to the Tyler case that could result in more money being needed for future Tyler settlement. So I have a little bit of standoffishness to spend the money that we have left over because we very well could need it for future Tyler cases. So I needed to vet that, and I didn't get an answer before committee today. So I apologize. I wasn't able to get that ready in time. So that's just one thing I wanted to put out there. Second, I don't think this is a dead issue by no means. I'm going to be a no today. I'll say that right now. But I don't think this is a dead issue. I think we can get there. We have time. It's budget neutral. That gives us more flexibility. But I also just saw some interesting reports, and I want to just pull up the numbers here. We just had the kind of like rent collected numbers come in for the state of Minnesota for March 6th. And if you compare it to years past, they are the exact same. So I understand we've talked to this committee. We know there's a crisis. But if we look at just the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and St. Cloud area. In March of 25, it was a 96.3% of rent collection, and in March 6th of this year, it was 96.3%. So, yes, there's a crisis for multiple reasons, but we're not in something crazy new. And that's why I think jumping into this and giving her money that could have a future settlement involved, we're going to hopefully have a target coming down the pipeline, we're going to be working on a budget. Co-Chair Howard and I wrote a very strong bipartisan budget that took care of FHPAP last year. I stand committed in doing that again, but at this time I just can't support it. But I appreciate the work and I appreciate the diligence in finding this fund, and I'm not saying we can't use it in the future, but I just don't have the answers in front of me right now.
Representative Kozlowski to that.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Howard and Chair Igo. I appreciate the willingness to continue to log roll and figure this out, just as we did in the bill that we're bringing to the House floor tomorrow to plug the holes from the federal government with the HUD and COC. This is using the same providers, those same trusted partners in the FHPAP, CAP, across a continuum of care. To the point of the Tyler dollars, that's actually something that we're really hoping that you'd be willing to move the bill on to the tax committee so we can continue to work through this, just as we did yesterday with the bill that we all said, hey, we had some concerns, but in good faith, we wanted to make sure that we can continue to do that good work and make the bill stronger and narrow it down and balance our concerns with also making sure we meet the needs of our housing providers and tenants. And so, but with the Tyler dollars, actually the time to be able to submit a claim has passed. There were over 8,000 potential applications and just about 1,000 that actually applied. So we are continuing to talk through with the Department of Revenue as well as with the AG and the court administrator on that to get specific numbers on cases and how that will turn out in the end in terms of the remaining balance for those claims. We also worked with House Fiscal to think through language that we could put additional guardrails to make sure that the dollars are preserved for the outstanding claims before taking more funds out for the rental assistance. So I am very committed, as well, we both are, continuing to work with you, but that just really, again, solidifies like the ask, let us move this bill to taxes to keep doing the good work and make it stronger and vet those answers.
Anything, Court Chair Igo? Representative Scraba.
You know, I wasn't gonna speak on this, but there's a Tyler 2 coming. You know that, right? Are you aware of that in the Supreme Court right now? There's a similar case. The Supreme Court heard it last week. We had a lot of St. Louis County people there, and they listened. They maybe Annie or someone actually got to listen in the court, and they came back and said, it's coming again. So we know it's coming again. There's going to be something there. Is it worth saving? We might have to put more away from another time. That's a different issue, I agree. But, you know, something Mamami Hiltzi said, this is just a bridge. And we heard earlier testimony when the $50 million was asked for from the city councilor from Minneapolis, basically saying, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We're not even close to what we need. And Nothing pains me more to know that there's people out there that need help and can't get help. And I'm going to refer back to my life. I was in Europe for a month, and I didn't see this, and I didn't understand why I didn't see it. You know, why I didn't see homelessness? Why I'm in a city of 2 million people, Vienna. There's not one homeless person anywhere. And I'm like, what do they do different than we do? Well, part of it is they're taxed between 48 and 52%. So it's all taken care of already. So they don't have to come and do this. And so I'm not saying that we should tax ourselves more all the time, but I'm saying that this problem is more systemic. This problem is way more systemic. It's not just this point of time that we need 40 million. It's not now. It was 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, today, tomorrow, and on. So I disagree. It's not a bridge. It's a Hail Mary for this group of people right now. Is it going to help? Obviously, it's going to help. But next week, there's going to be another group saying, we need it too. We need it too. And the part that I'm having the biggest struggle with is the counties have, there are, in my opinion, they are our arms. We give them money, they do the work. And this bill has some of that in it. And I like that part. And that's the part I think I can get behind and work behind. But the whole premise of where we are right now and why we are where we are is it's hard for me to get behind it totally. And that's my issue right now. I hear it, I see it, I sense it, I feel it. But at the same time, I don't think we as a citizenry are doing enough. That's all. And I think this $40 million is a lot of money. My constituents have, a lot of them have notified me, you know, please don't, please don't. There are some that say, yes, this, you know, do it. And the question that I have is this the end? Is this going to be just one time $40 million? Thank you, Chair.
Representative Kozlowski or Representative Baje?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Scraba, for sharing that. I mean, you touch on a lot of issues within housing that we've wrestled with in this committee, right? It's like, how do we support people? How do we help them? How do we make sure that they have their needs? And you think you almost gave Representative Nash a heart attack over there talking about one method. But I agree, there's, yes. In addition to that method, there's also other methods, right? Like, we can continue on the conversations we've been having about building more housing, right? The zoning work that we've been doing. We can also continue to have conversations about what it means to make sure that we have private equity out of single family homes. We can continue talking about what it means to ensure that we have enough money for our homeless shelters. We can continue talking about what it means to make sure that we have enough money to help people who need help with the rent when they need it, but also how can we make sure that the rent comes down over time. There's a variety of areas where we can work together. I think for this particular bill and for this particular need, you know, the people that we want to help are people who would otherwise have been going to work and never would have come to ask us for help. They would have otherwise been opening their businesses and never would have come to ask us for help. This is through no fault of their own. And part of the way the calendar works, especially from the eviction law perspective, is yes, we do have a 14-day notice in the state. Some cities have up to a 30-day notice. It will take time for them before they get into court. And even when they do get into court, there's still going to be delays in that space. And so what we're hoping is that those built-in time periods will allow folks to be able to reach out to get the resources they need so they can make do and make whole with their landlord, and so they can stay in that home. Because then what you didn't see in Europe, but we see here, is that we unfortunately tell people that you don't have the money, whether it's, you know, especially when it's no fault of their own, you don't have the money, so now you have to go either out on the street or into substandard housing. And the fact that we allow that in this country, while also saying we're one of the richest countries in the world, is something that I think we need to wrestle with. And so I hope that you will continue in conversations with all of us to figure out what is the best way to get there. But I do believe that this could be one step of trying to help people in those situations.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you, both of you, for bringing this bill forward. And how do we get here in the first place? That's what we need to ask each other. And the state, we went through a lot. We went through COVID. We went through civil unrest. And we also went through Metro Surge, which put behind a lot of people who are residents or citizens behind their rental. And if we don't take care of those people, the homeless that we're talking about is going to increase. This is the time that we can protect for those people. We're not giving a year for rental assistance, but sometimes people could lose job. They could have a sick family members. There's a lot of things that can happen. I have seen, and I have a lot of people that reach out to my office that we was that really appreciated for the rental assistance that we did 2023-2024, that give them 2 months or a month until they find a job. They say, representative, you prevent us to be homeless or to be behind our rental. We cannot have our kids place for them to take it. This is the time that we need to do the right thing. And if we compare it to Europe and in America, Europe take care of their constituents a lot. You know, they have a sick time pays, that we just doing it, like they have a lot of time off, not a lot of offer times. There's a housings. They have health care free, a lot of the countries, which we do not have here. We really make our constituents and our people, we fail them as the legislators. We need to do right thing for those people that really need help. This is not a handout, it's help that give by what they need for that month or to get to until they find a job. I am really supporting this bill. We are overwhelming phone calls that we getting from our state. Our citizens are asking us to help for those people that really need it. When it comes to housing, we have a lot to address in the state of Minnesota. We are behind so much, but if we work together the same way that we worked all together in this committee, Chair Igo and Chair Howard was leading us, a platform and bills that reflect the community, that we did something tangible, that we get back to our citizens. This is what we need to do, the same thing this year, and this is an urgent matter. It's not an illegal or legal. We need to take care for our residents and our citizens. Thank you very much for bringing this bill forward, and we will continue to support the people that really need it. This is help, not a handout. Thank you very much.
I'll just make a few comments and then go to the authors. Thank you again for bringing this bill forward. And again, just want to remind folks that on the this is a crisis in front of us, and it's a crisis that existed before Operation Metro Surge. We had some of the highest eviction numbers in our state's history. But then what happened, as both representatives have mentioned, during Operation Metro Surge is people were forced to stay home essentially against their will. They wanted to be working. This was done upon people. And community has responded to help folks, and the legislature needs to as well. When we heard this bill, one of the main criticism was we don't know the budget picture, and it spends $50 million. We do know the budget picture now. It has improved. And not only that, this bill is cost neutral. It costs $0. And to put a finer point on it, if we do nothing, these Tyler dollars cancel back to the general fund. There isn't a legislative mechanism right now to just keep this money around. And what better use of these funds right now? They were, as mentioned, appropriated after folks' homes were essentially taken from them. And now we can use those funds to help people stay in their homes. It is an elegant, urgent matter and the right thing to do. Would really encourage to move this bill to the next step so we can keep having this conversation, because the matter is urgent. I do appreciate, you know, Representative Scraba's point that, you know, is this going to help? You're damn right this is going to help. And we should be the helpers right now, because our constituents are in so much pain. And I do appreciate Co-Chair Igo's commitment to work together on this issue. I will say I was less heartened by words from Speaker Damuth. I saw in the newspaper just today commenting on this proposal, you know, saying her caucus doesn't support this. because people were making the choice not to go to work. And I have to share a story. I shared this in state government of one of my constituents. And it's important in this work that we ground ourselves in the actual stories of our constituents and what has occurred. On an early morning in January in Richfield, a family of four awoke to the news that ICE had somehow entered their apartment building without a warrant. In the scuffle, the mother and the daughter were detained by ICE. I would note that the mother and the father, both here legally, having legal status, neither have a criminal record, working in our community. The mother, before the family knew where they had been taken, by that evening, they were already in Texas. The father is the sole breadwinner, the main breadwinner, and had to face the choice, am I going to go to work to provide for my family or stay home? And I just want you to imagine the son tugging at his father's pants saying, don't go to work. I've already lost my mom. I can't lose my dad. What choice is that? Mm-hmm. I would ask all of us, what choice is that? What would you do if you were that father and your son was asking you to stay home because he was worried he'll never see you again? Those stories are playing out and have played out all across our state. And what we're doing in this bill is saying, we are going to try to help you get through. It is the moral thing to do. It is the right thing to do. And we have the ability. I do believe that folks on the other side have the ability to hear those stories and have empathy and find a place to take action. I hope that that time is today, because every day we don't take action is another day that someone is going to lose their home and face the consequences of an eviction. I hope that time is today, but at a minimum, I would just ask each of my colleagues to really hear that story and put yourself in the shoes of that father and ask yourself, what would you do, and find a place to help them. And with that, I'll go to Representative Kozlowski and Representative Igbaje for the final word before we take a vote.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members. You know, it was said here, if we want housing like Vienna, then we need to fund housing like Vienna. In lieu of that, thousands of Minnesotans are facing evictions. They are on the doorsteps of falling into homelessness. Over 100,000 Minnesotans have had their utilities shut off, and this bill will take care of both. I think it's really easy to just kind of scroll past and gloss over the thousands of Minnesotans who are seeking rental assistance, who are desperately crowdsourcing and piecemealing money together to help their neighbors. But we know that these are real impacts. When families lose housing, landlords lose revenue. Our small businesses are already hurting. That means that they're going to lose even more revenue. Children missing school, that impacts our local school districts. When kids aren't there, the school district doesn't get to collect the funds. And as we heard from our county, which, by the way, is one of the biggest reasons why we needed to make that $109 million investment in the Tyler settlements, because St. Louis County was one that had the biggest impact. But it's our local governments who absorb those downstream costs, as well as the rest of our infrastructure onto our emergency rooms. And I'll tell you, in greater Minnesota, we just do not have the shelter infrastructure, as we heard, overextended, turning folks away. And so what happens when more folks are cast into the cycle of homelessness? So we know that if we stabilize housing, we'll stabilize anything. And Chair, I think you said it best. You know, we're kids, I think, that probably grew up with Mr. Rogers. Look for the helpers. And right now, Minnesotans are stepping in to take care and help each other. And the least we can do is use our power, use the money that's right here, right now. It's going to go away. We have the tools, we have the resources, we have the money. Let's help Minnesotans who need it most.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. We'll move to a vote.
Co-Chair Howard.
Aye.
Howard votes aye. Co-Chair Igo.
Igo no.
Igo votes nay. Vice Co-Chair Kozlowski.
Yes.
Kozlowski votes aye. Vice Co-Chair Dotseth.
No.
Dotseth votes nay. Representative Buck.
Huh, yes.
Buck votes aye. Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Hussein votes aye. Representative Johnson. Representative Mekeland.
No.
Mekeland votes nay. Representative Bomani Hiltzley.
Bomani Hiltzley, aye.
Bomani Hiltzley votes aye. Representative Myers.
Nay.
Myers votes nay. Representative Nash.
No.
Nash votes nay. Representative Norris.
Aye.
Norris votes aye. Representative Rayrauer.
Aye.
Rayrauer votes aye. Representative Scraba.
Nay.
Scraba votes nay. Representative Johnson.
With a vote of 7 ayes and 6 nays, and 1 excused, the bill does not pass. It needs 8 votes to move on to the next committee. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski, Representative Bajay. And Representative Bajay, you get to stay. Members, the second bill on the agenda is House File 2687. This is the restrictions on corporate homeownership. We heard this bill and had testimony in a discussion last week, but wanted to make sure that all members, including our co-chair, had an opportunity to be part of any discussion and ultimately a vote on this bill. So I will make the motion that we move this bill to be brought in front of the committee and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. I see that Representative Nash has a question.
Mr. Chair, would you mind asking members of the audience to silence their phones for us, please?
Yes, if members could silence their phones, we would appreciate it. Thank you. Representative Bajay, would you like to just give a quick refresh of the bill that's before us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just as a quick refresher, this bill has been significantly pared down from when it was originally introduced. It now is strictly a prohibition on private equity corporations from owning single-family homes and then limiting ownership of corporations, partnerships, to only 50 single-family homes in the state of Minnesota. The enforcement would be done through the Attorney General's office.
Thank you. Members, I see Representative Nash, did you have further comments or was that from previously? Okay. You're ready, you're up. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bajay, I do appreciate the amount of change that has been made. You know that I'm dispositionally still not there. I think I had asked you last week, and I don't know that I got an answer that I was 100% clear on, but the divestment of these, I think you were going to come back with an answer on what was going to happen, or was the answer at the time that it would still go to forcible auction?
No.
Because that was in the original language a couple years ago, and just wanted to make sure what the mechanism is. Mr. Chair.
Representative Bajay.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. No, that was not in the original bill. The original bill was a divestiture schedule of 2 years. We have taken out a divestiture schedule. I've actually spoken with my Senate co-author. There is bipartisan support in the Senate for the bill. We do understand that we will need to come up with a divestiture schedule. It is likely that as that bill moves either in the Senate or hopefully here, we'll put that together and it'll be in the next committee so that way we have a fuller schedule, ideally taking a significant amount of time for that divestiture in the past. But as we talked about last week, the bill is forward-looking, so the enforcement would only apply moving forward to companies who would exceed that limit after the enactment date of, I think it's like August of 2026. Of course, should this bill move forward, we still want to have those conversations of when that date actually should be. So, but at this point, no, we do not have a divestiture schedule, but that needs to be cleared with both House and Senate partners on what that would look like.
President Nash?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, you know, I'm a free market person, and everybody knows that. This is not a surprise. I don't believe that this is a free market solution. This is not something that I can bring myself to support, and I'm voting no. I would ask for a roll call.
There will be a roll call. Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Bajay. Question I have is there a reason why the Department of why the Attorney General's office is actually enforcing this instead of the Department of Commerce.
Representative Bajaj.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dotsett. I think both of us in both chambers decided that since the Attorney General already has experience in their office of going after kind of landlords who have multiple homes that they weren't taking care of, Havenbrook Homes is one of the main examples that the state has gone after. So because they have that experience, so should a report get to them that there is another large corporation or private equity firm that is violating this law, they would be in the best place, considering their history, to enforce this.
Representative Dotson.
I appreciate your response, but my understanding, typically a real estate matter like this, this would actually go through the Department of Congress, our Commerce. Would this actually go through Commerce Committee as far as for a hearing as well?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, we are not going through the Commerce Committee because it's just a state of laws and because we're also using the Attorney General's office. They also, even if Commerce has an issue, they would bring in the Attorney General at some point. So I don't see where that is right now. We don't have a specific line item that references the Department of Commerce.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Buck.
Madame Yaya, thank you. Honestly, I don't see why you'd be against this, and I hope at some point in time I can fully understand and get a clear answer that I can't understand as to why. The way the current process works, this inflates housing prices for the average, for average people. And shockingly, actually Trump even included it in his State of the Union speech. So I don't know who in the communities are telling you to vote against this. I know no one in my community or my district is. So, Padami Ayepi, thank you for this bill, and thank you.
Coach Rago.
Thank you, Co-Chair Howard. So I want to apologize that I missed the hearing last week. I was looking forward to having a conversation on this, so I'm glad we're having it now. I want to start with thanks, Representative Abaji. You've done a ton of work on this bill, and I want to give credit where credit is due. I really like the exceptions in here, like that's doing your homework. But I like, this is why, and I, maybe I'll just get into questions. The first question that I kind of wanted to ask is, when we're looking at exceptions, is there protected? Here's a situation that came to my head right away. Private developer A builds 50 single family homes and wants to turn them into rentals, or 51 in this case. Turns them into rentals. They're an LLC and going to make single-family homes. They turn into rentals. Would that be then against the law with the way this language is written?
Representative Igbaje.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So if they're at 51 and it's a LLC partnership corporation, they would be in violation of the law as written because the 50 is the cap. If they were underneath 50, they could still do their business. So.
Coach Rago.
Thank you, Representative Abashi. And that's just kind of one of the things that I worried about and why I'm really trying to do my homework with you on this thing, because as we're trying to do everything we possibly can to make housing more affordable, if there's ma and pops out there that found a new way to build out homes and want to start LLCs to do it and make them be affordable, like for all we know, tomorrow someone's going to discover a way to build a 1,200 square foot house for $100,000. And they're going to pump them all out, and they're going to have 100 of them and 50 acres, and they're going to put them on eighth-acre lots. But then if we do this bill today, it's illegal for them to do that and market that business plan and bring affordable homes to Minnesota. So, like, that was one of the – and I know I'm kind of being a devil's advocate, if you will, but I really want to think twice, act once when we're talking about preemption to how the state's free market works around housing. The second question I had was around – it's on the back, and I'm glad there is note of it, so I just want to clarify, and maybe you covered it. Is the mortgage note holder that owned the single-family homes through the foreclosure. So, again, my what-if on that, since there's a secondary mortgage market and we see a lot of large corporation equity firms buying and trading those things and swapping those things, is that going to prohibit the secondary mortgage market from being active in the state of Minnesota? Because the side effect of that would be increased mortgage rates and destabilize the ability to get mortgages.
Representative Bajaj.
Thank you for the question. I don't believe so, but I would, you know, we had been given a list of folks and groups that wanted to be accepted from this. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of the reason why the mortgage note holder could be accepted is because of the foreclosure issue. But I'm happy to like go back to partners and kind of talk that through to see if there's a more elegant way of writing that exception. But I think the idea was we wanted to accept folks who we knew were either working directly with people or working directly on building housing developments that could be sold to individuals and families. You know, we wanted to accept, of course, the public agencies. And I think there also the idea is just to make sure to protect people who already own their homes rather than having to force them into the corporate market. So, but if there's a more elegant way to write that, I'm sure we'd be happy to do that. And I think that's why hopefully moving it forward can help with updating those amendments.
Coach Rago?
Thank you, Representative Igbaji. And again, you've done your homework, and I'm just trying to do mine too. I think there is a place we can get there. And when I looked around the country, I'm trying to see like other states that are working. New York is the other state that's working on this, correct?
Representative Bajay?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's also Kentucky, Iowa. I think Florida also has one. Georgia has one. So there's a number of states that are looking at this, and they're across the political spectrum. So it's not, this is definitely not like a partisan issue. Folks are really looking at how can they make sure that more housing stays in the homes of individuals and families. So, yeah.
Yeah, don't forget about President Trump, too. Coach Rago?
So, and again, that's what I've been following. At this point, I'm getting there, and I need to continue doing my homework. So at this point right now, I'm not going to be ready to give you a yes vote on it. That doesn't mean I'm not going to keep working with you on it. Again, I really want to emphasize the bill that you have in front of us today, you've done a lot of work on, and I want to give you credit for that. I wish I could give you the yes vote today. I'm just not quite there yet because I want to iron out some things and make sure we're not going to be making, and I've said it before in this committee, when we pass legislative action, we can't think about what it's going to do 6 months from now. We got to think about what it's going to do 20 years from now when all of us aren't in these chairs. And, you know, if you're going to do something, you got to take the time and really think about it because these decisions matter, especially when we're talking about the free market of home ownership in the state of Minnesota. So, again, thank you for the work. We'll be in touch. I'm going to keep working on my end. We'll find a way to get something here.
Thank you, Representative Bajay, for the bill. And, you know, we do have an opportunity to keep working on it in a number next committee stops. I mean, that's kind of how this process works. And so we definitely encourage a yes vote so we can keep having those conversations. I mean, ultimately, this is about putting more power in the hands of people who are really struggling to find that dream of owning a home. And it's, I think, as Representative Buck mentioned, when you talk to regular folks about this, like, this is a no-brainer. And I think it could be for us, too. So, Representative Igbaji, to your bill before we take a vote.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for letting me bring it back in front of the committee. And thank you for your questions, Co-Chair Igo. You know, I think all of these questions are completely valid. This is part of the committee process. We get feedback. We make amendments. We move it to the next committee. So I really encourage votes to be able to do that process. We're working with our counterparts in the other body who are also doing that work. And we want to make sure that we do get this right. And that's why I really hope I can count on your support to move this forward to the next step. Thank you.
With that, Mr. Smith will take the roll.
Co-Chair Howard?
Aye.
Howard votes aye. Co-Chair Igo?
No.
Howard Igo votes nay. Vice Co-Chair Kozlowski?
Yes.
Kozlowski votes aye. Vice Co-Chair Dotsev?
Nay.
Dotsev votes nay. Representative Buck?
Huh, yes.
Buck votes aye. Representative Hussein?
Aye.
Hussein votes aye. Representative Johnson? Representative Meckland?
Nay.
Meckland votes nay. Representative Womani Hiltzley?
Womani Hiltzley, aye.
Womani Hiltzley votes aye. Representative Myers?
Nay.
Myers votes nay. Representative Nash?
No.
Nash votes nay. Representative Norris?
Aye.
Norris votes aye. Representative Rayrauer?
Aye.
Rayrauer votes aye. Representative Scraba?
Nay.
Scraba votes nay. Representative Johnson?
As with the previous bill, there were 7 ayes and 6 nays. The motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representative Igbaji. Our third bill, House Bill 2381, Representative Norris.
What's the optimum number?
Representative Norris, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Chair Howard. I move House File 2381 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
The bill is before us, and I also note that you have the A-12 amendment. Would you briefly describe the A-12?
Yes, thank you, Chair Howard. Members, the A-12 amendment, I wouldn't call it a technical amendment. It's a wonky amendment. There's a little bit of substance in there. It essentially is tightening up some of the language, particularly around the opportunity to purchase provision. Since this bill was last heard, we've had an opportunity to consult with some national experts, look at the state of the law in other states, and so we're cleaning up some of the language in the A-12 amendment.
Any discussion to the A-12? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A-12 is adopted. Representative Norris, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Members of the committee, we brought this bill forward last year, so the committee should be familiar with the basics. There are about 180,000 Minnesotans living in the state's roughly 800 manufactured home communities across the state. 90% of those Minnesotans live in a manufactured home community where they own their home but rent the land underneath it. This halfway home ownership structure makes manufactured housing unique from other housing markets and calls for similarly unique consumer protections, especially because private equity firms have been increasingly buying up the parks and raising the rents. Members, this problem has only gotten worse since we last heard this bill. 85% of manufactured home park sales in Minnesota last year were to out-of-state buyers. Another park in my district was recently purchased by a private equity firm. And you guessed it, the lot rent promptly increased $100 per month. In another park in my district, I recently learned of a resident who gets charged $25 per week as a late fee on her $500 a month lot rent. What has also happened since we last met is other states are starting to take action. For instance, Washington State passed a law last year that keeps manufactured home park lot rents reasonable. Bills have been introduced in several other states as well. And six states since 2020 have passed a resident opportunity to purchase law. So the time is now, members. Residents are at risk of losing their homes, and they cannot wait on more inaction by the legislature. I urge you to support passage of this bill. Thank you.
First up for testifiers is Tammy Fry, resident from Blaine International Village. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Tammy Fry, and I live in Blaine International Village in Blaine, Minnesota. I've lived in my community for over 13 years. I'm a proud homeowner who was able to purchase my home on my own as a single woman. My park was privately owned for the first 9 years that I resided there, and I paid $325 a month for lot rent. And in 9 years under private ownership, my lot rent increased a total of $100 or $15 annually. In 2021, a private equity firm purchased and within the first 60 days raised our lot rent $60 and have raised it $60 annually since, if not more for some. I now pay over $700 a month for the dirt under my home. I worked at a Big Four accounting firm that had private equity clients. It is always profit over people. I had a great income. I was living comfortably. And then in 2023, I took early retirement to care for my parents. As a result, I lost 2/3 of my income. My stepfather passed away just months after I retired, and my mother passed this last December. It was always my intention that once my folks passed, I would sell my home and move out of the cities. I now feel trapped as I cannot sell my home. New owners coming into the park are paying over $1,000 in lot rent on top of homeowners insurance, property taxes, and utilities. Affordable housing is no more, and we are in crisis. I, along with the other homeowners, are here today asking you to support our bill and, most urgently, the 3% lot rent cap. No other policy in this bill will matter if we don't have a place to live. There are people in parks across the state that are experiencing even worse than me. I know because I was on a team that door knocked in 36 parks, knocked 10,000 doors to listen to residents' stories and developed policy to start to address their concerns. I have 3,500 petition signatures in support of this bill. I am no pro. I am not paid. I am just a homeowner who's willing to take the time and the effort to get this bill passed because I can't stand how we as manufactured homeowners are being treated by faceless corporations. You have an opportunity to do something about this. This should not be about politics, but humanity and dignity. Frankly, I don't understand why anyone in this chamber would support out-of-state private equity firms stealing the livelihoods of your constituents. I thank you for this opportunity to address this committee.
Thank you. Next, we have Mark Bruner, President of Manufacturing Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We represent the nearly 900 privately owned manufactured home communities in the state, as well as the spokespersons for the 15 plants that build new manufactured and modular homes. We're the largest source of non-subsidized attainable housing in Minnesota. However, we have several concerns with the bill. First off, it eliminates fundamental property rights. It imposes rent control, requires justifying rent increases, and repeals a negotiated settlement between the cooperative groups and the industry that has only been operational for 2 years and recently was hailed by the state's largest cooperative group as the reason they were able to acquire a community in Zumbrota, Minnesota. The bill turns the current notice of unsolicited sale, which I was just referencing, into a first right of refusal on every sale of a community, granting leaseholders and non-vested organizations the ability to violate a property owner's constitutional right to transfer or sell their property or secure a first option to purchase. The only cooperative in Minnesota making acquisitions is well-funded, both by the state of Minnesota, recently with a $10 million grant to help facilitate acquisitions, and then another grant by the Department of Housing and Urban Development for around $20 million to help facilitate those acquisitions. So the groups are funded to make the acquisitions. They don't need an additional step in terms of a right of first refusal to interfere with the sale of a manufactured home community. Regarding the bill's rent control, the chilling effect rent control has on the development and expansion of affordable housing is not hypothetical. The reality is best demonstrated by what happened following Minneapolis and St. Paul's adopting rent control ordinances, with the resulting developers fleeing the Twin Cities and going outstate to greater Minnesota or even beyond. This bill, however, isn't just a local ordinance type requirement. It's statewide rent control that would be applied to every manufactured home community in Minnesota, whether or not they've excessively increased rents or not in the recent past. So how much would a 3% rent increase cap generate for revenue in an average community? So let's say the average community in Minnesota has 100 homes. With the vast majority of the of those saying at a $500 per month rent for the home site, it would increase their monthly rent a max of $15 per home per month and generate additional $18,000 a year, which would have to cover increased property tax rates, any infrastructure work that needs to be done. So 3%, you'd be capped. What happens then if they can't meet those other obligations? The property then heads into a downward spiral where repairs aren't made, maintenance doesn't happen, and then we probably see legislation brought forward to require them to make those kinds of repairs. So we believe the adverse effects of this bill, the unintended consequences, will have a detrimental effect on affordable housing in Minnesota. In conclusion, economics and history teaches us that in a free market, demand and supply will be balanced. An unregulated housing market, shortages are addressed first by higher rents, responding to the scarcity and higher demand, and then by an increase in supply that self-regulates the market. But when rents are restricted, there's no attraction to new investment in housing, supply will stagnate, and the development of additional manufactured home communities, which are Minnesota's largest source of non-subsidized workforce housing, will evaporate. The best way to bring down rents is through initiatives that encourage development and expansion of existing manufactured home communities and increase the supply. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Carlson, owner of Mike's Ives Realty. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Howard, Co-Chair Igo, and other committee members. My name is Michelle Carlson. I'm a second-generation manufactured home community owner, broker, and dealer, and I'm here to speak in opposition of this house file. I am not a faithless community owner. I have been providing clean housing in professional managed manufactured home community for over 30 years. And I have in my community people of all ages, all backgrounds, all income levels that have chosen to live in my community without the financial burden of land ownership. They have choice. And this bill is spreading false premise that I, as a community owner, outrageously are increasing my rent, that I'm failing to maintain my communities, and that I'm hurting my residents. It is so not true. As a community owner, I'm very sensitive to rent increases and how it affects my residents. Many of my residents have been with me for generations. And putting rent control restrictions upon my industry also eliminates my ability to adjust as necessary to these uncontrolled fluctuation of market expenses. This might be increases in utilities, vendor expenses such as asphalt, concrete, tree maintenance, trash removal, insurance increases, and especially the increases that we've incurred over the last 5 years with government expenses such as property tax increases, of which I had one in the Duluth area of over 200%, licensing expenses, and permitting expenses. Rent control will hurt all Minnesotans, restricting owners from updating their properties and new businesses from developing. I always want to operate my communities at the highest level for my residents and giving them a well-maintained community that they're proud to call home. We are, as manufactured home community owners, the biggest advocates of non-subsidized affordable housing. In rural Minnesota, we need affordable housing, yet we need you to support us as a business. And why should I build or increase and expand my communities if I don't have your support? As our founding fathers stated, property rights are the cornerstone of American liberty. No one has the right to take our property rights away without warranting full and fair compensation for these valued property rights, yet you wish to take mine, not allowing me to market my property asset or sell my community in the future to a buyer of my choice is not acceptable. And there is no reason why it should be. And as a manufactured home community owner, we deserve better from you as Minnesota lawmakers. I support affordable, non-subsidized housing options in rural Minnesota. And this is what Minnesota needs. We need your help to make sure that that happens. And don't hinder my ability to provide this kind of manufactured housing with rent control and with rent justification and with unjust, uncompensated taking of property rights. We certainly deserve better. Please support us as community owners to provide affordable housing into the future. Please do not support this bill.
Next on the list is Dave Check, owner of Trimark.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Dave Zeck. I reside in Blaine, Minnesota, and own a manufactured housing community in Blaine, Minnesota. I'm here today to speak against the bill. I know I haven't seen a two-minute warning, you know, this hearing, but I'm going to try to. I was prepped for it, so I'm going to try to.
I appreciate that very much.
Try to keep you on that schedule.
Yeah, thank
right?
you.
So, even though I think I could talk your ear off with my concerns about the bill. I think I'm going to focus, one of the things I want to talk about is the rent control component. Government is one of our largest cost drivers. I mean, taxes, I mean, we can go down the list. I mean, I think our property taxes, water, sewer, have averaged 18% increases 3 years in a row. Like, I've done this for 45 years. I've never seen, usually you get a blip and things settle down. It just keeps going. So I don't know how we operate with some sort of cap. A pretty traditional argument about rent control has to do with future development. People say, well, there hasn't been a community developed in many years, so you don't get to use that argument. So I want you to understand how a manufactured housing community survives for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. Okay, it internally redevelops all the time. Right? We take old houses, get them out, we refurbish the lot, we update utilities. Now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would look at you and tell you, like, actually, for me to get rid of a house, it's not going to cost me a grand. Last year, we removed two of what we'd call pre-code houses, very bad shape. Now, these are residents that walk away from them, right? We don't, you know, there's no magic elixir. We take those houses and we have to get rid of them. Those two houses average $18,000. A piece to remove to get a lot so we can get somebody to put a house on that so we have a house and availability for consumer. In Minnesota, we're required to have uniform lot rent, which means if I had an apartment and a resident moved out and I painted it and put in new carpet and put in new appliances and made it beautiful, I could probably charge that resident more than their neighbor because I did that work. I don't get to do that. I have to charge them the same amount. So my whole community is going to absorb that cost, even though there's one person, one family that's going to get the largest benefit, that everybody pays the same rate. So those are the, if you're going to tell me, I can't do that anymore, right? Like, as communities age, more houses fall into that trap of, you know, poor maintenance, they need to be replaced, and how do we do that? That's a very difficult and costly endeavor, which, if you want the community to be around in another 20, 30 years, we have to go through, right? If we walk away from that, those are the kind of the declines you see in communities where residents don't want to live anymore. That's my big push on that. Obviously, speak against the opportunity to purchase or first right of refusal. And I do want to make a short talk on something that we don't talk about, and that, because we seem to acquiesce to the point that resident ownership is the caveat, catch me all, well, the world's going to be better when that happens. The community, right alongside my community, was sold in a free market situation by that owner to the residents quite a few years ago. The bank took it back. I don't know what the situation was. It didn't work. They took it back. It's converted a private party. The residents didn't buy it out of the bank. Now a private party's bought it. They have brand new roads. They have new houses coming in all the time. It's a community that now has the opportunity for the first time in the last 20 years to probably still be a viable community 30 years from now. It's not the only answer, right? We have answers. We work hard on our properties. I don't know. I'm gonna take a timeout right there.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Last on the list is John Pettit, resident of Ardmore Village.
Thank
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sean Pettit. I am a resident of Ardmore Village in Lakeville, Minnesota. We moved in November of 2009, and our rent was approximately $450 a month. It was reasonable for us at the time. Private equity came in about 7 years later, and immediately the rent started going up. I am now paying over, and this is water included, but I am now paying over $900 a month. I expect that to be over $1,000 in the coming year. This is very difficult to manage. I'm 66 years old, moving towards a fixed income. I have a disability with mobility issues, so does my wife, and I've been working hard all of my life to be able to afford a place to live. It's becoming increasingly out of reach. My wife also is chronically ill, and so we have a medical debt. We have an increasing credit card debt as we're trying to make ends meet. This is not a simple thing of it's not so much about rent control as it is about stopping price gouging, which is what is happening to us. It's the increases have gone so far out of our ability to pay for it, to maintain our homes that this is part of what's contributing to the housing crisis. We've had to make some hard financial choices in order to deal with monthly expenses. We've had to forego vacations. We've had to forego purchases that we may have wanted. Our son's future is in question too, because how are we going to pay for college? We're not asking for money from the state here. We're asking for a bit of control, reining in private equity. I mean, this is what we have laws for, is to keep people or groups of people from running amok. And we feel that this is what's happening to us. The quality of services have gone down in the time that the new ownership has taken over. You may have heard some years ago about a mobile home community that went without water for an entire Thanksgiving weekend. That was us. We had no water from Thursday through Sunday for Thanksgiving. And so this is because of a pipe broke and they were slow in getting it fixed until the following week. We had bad roads that the city finally had to step in and deny permits and new building permits until the community fixed it. And it's things like this that the residents go through, not just in my community but in others. We need controls. We need to private equity. I mean, if they want to own the community, that's fine, but be responsible to their customers. And as far as our ability to point number two in the bill, our ability to have a seat at the table, what's wrong with that? We would like an opportunity of right of first refusal. That doesn't mean that they have to sell to us. I mean, it's clearly if another buyer comes in with a better offer, that's fine, but we'd like a seat at the table. It is not a big ask. As I said, we're not asking for money from the state, we're just asking for a few controls. And this is it's frustrating.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That is our list of testifiers, and we have some time for member discussion. Representative Ray Rauer.
Great. Thank you, Chair Howard. I'd like to share that I also have a manufactured home park in my district. I had a listening session with the folks of Creekside Estates, and they really shared with me that they love where they live. They chose this place. They chose it for the safety. They chose it for the affordability. When I was in that area in the park last summer, it really reminded me of the neighborhood I grew up in. Kids were all over the place. Kids were riding their bikes, playing games together. It was very quiet. It felt very safe. They chose it because, again, it's safe and it was affordable for them. Many of these folks were on fixed incomes. They were living on Social Security, were retired. Also talked to a resident who, he chose the life he chose. He chose to work at a food shelf. He knew that he was never going to make a lot of money doing that. He knew that, you know, he wasn't going to be wealthy, but he loved his job because he was giving back to the community and helping people. And these are the folks living in these parks. So what really was upsetting, though, is that all of them were terrified. It's privately owned. They've had the same owner for a long time, and they're terrified that it's going to be sold to private equity. Because in Blaine, right next door to Coon Rapids, where I am, they know of folks whose lot rents have more than doubled, and they know that they won't be able to afford that. In addition, they know of folks who have lost their homes because of this. So when you own a manufactured home, you own only the home. You don't own the land under the home. Some of them have mortgages completely paid off. And yet they're at risk of losing that home that they own. I believe it was brought up property rights by somebody testifying against this earlier. Well, they have a property right to that home they own. But if the lot rent more than doubles, they can't afford it. And even though they've been called mobile homes, they're not actually very mobile, especially for folks with a low income. The cost of moving that home is often out of reach for these folks. They may have built decks that they have spent 20 years paying for and adding on to this property that they live on. So when that lot rent doubles and they can't afford it, and they can't afford to move their home, and they get evicted, they actually lose that whole home that they own outright. So I love your bill. I support these residents. I think we need to take this action, and we need to ensure these folks can stay in their homes that they love and that is safe and that is affordable for them. So I support your bill. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Oh, excuse me. Oh,
Representative Rehrauer.
Chair Howard, I'd also like to ask for a roll call vote.
We'll have a roll call. Thank you, Representative Rehrauer. Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Norris, if you would turn in your underlying bill language to Section 8, lines 3.22 through 3.29. I do have some questions for you, and I'll give you a chance to get there. Let me know. You ready? Okay.
Ready.
So you're capping rent at 3% in your bill, and your stipulations for what can be done if it goes over that are for the health and safety of the residents and only for the health and safety of the residents. First question I have is, who decides if something over 3% is reasonable? Is it a court? Is it a local municipality? I also see that it's a rent increase approved by the resident-owned co-op. So is the resident-owned co-op the group of jurisdiction? I'm trying to figure that out.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Howard and Representative Nash. The resident-owned cooperative language applies if the park is owned by a resident-owned cooperative. In the case of a privately owned park, it would be up to a resident of that park to challenge the rent increase as unreasonable in court, and then the park owner would have to provide clear and convincing evidence that the increase is necessary for the health and safety of the residents.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, let me give a scenario for you. So county levies have been going up. Everybody's county levies have been going up in response to paid family medical leave is now impacting counties. We all know that we've been trying through, I think Chair Baker and others are trying to work through the African American Preservation Act impact on counties. General levies are going up for counties. So if those in an additive formula go along with the needs of the repair of the park to, let's say, 7%. Let's just pick an arbitrary number. You're saying that that's not something that is permissible, would have to go through some sort of arbitration or court proceeding or something like that in order to be given as an acceptable number. Is that correct?
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, Representative Nash, yes, it would be a fact-specific situation that a court would have to look at in that particular case.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Norris, who bears the court costs?
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, Representative Nash, typically each litigant bears their own costs in court.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if each litigant has to bear the cost of that and they lose, they're now going further backwards. But the question that I have that really this comes down to is rent control hasn't been proven to work anywhere, and yet you're hell-bent on doing that, and you are going to hobble the landowner, which I take umbrage with. I think that just the series of things, and I wasn't even really digging that deep. I was just taking some of the highlight reels of recent years as to costs that are being layered on counties and layered on people that live in those counties. You know, for anyone who owns a home, sometimes the costs will surpass 3%. Maybe you've got something that you really need to do to improve the land and it goes beyond 3%. If a capricious court, and I will challenge you all to not find examples in modern media where courts have made capricious decisions. They have, and you know they have. So if a judge who doesn't really see it the way that the landowner does decides that their request for over 3% is reasonable, well, then the landowner is out of luck, just as you just said. So it doesn't require a lot of creativity to find scenarios under which 3% is nowhere near what landowners may need to cover their costs. And you articulate in here that they are responsible to provide for the safety and health of their residents. Well, what if they can't get over 3% and a judge decides to shoot them down? It's not a very good scenario. Rent control leads to slums. I'm a no.
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, what doesn't take any creativity is to know that right now residents are being priced out of their homes because of greed. We were able to get data from a portfolio of about 15 parks here in the state of Minnesota, and we were able to find, this is from 2024, the average cost to operate a single occupied site was about $3,295 per year. It equates to about $275 per month. That includes utilities, which are often passed on to the residents. Now, so if we take $275 a month as the baseline operating cost, and then consider the fact that you know, a lot of these lot rents these days are at least 500, 600, but now we're starting to see lot rents in the $800 to $1,000 range. That's a lot of margin there. And when you go into business as a business owner, there's no guarantee that you're going to make a profit. Costs may go up. Property taxes may go up. And your margin may shrink a bit because of that. But what we need to make sure is that residents who do not have equal bargaining power in this relationship because of the fact that they own the home but rent the land are not subject to undue leverage because of the unique nature of this hybrid home ownership model. There are lots of parks out across the state that have been operating with reasonable rent increases around 3%. There are parks that continue to operate with reasonable increases around 3%. And so the notion that this is impossible for the park owners to comply with just doesn't match with the facts.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Co-Chair Howard. So I had a measured response, and then I heard motives impugned. So I'm going to start there. We are not going to talk about some of the most affordable home providers in the state of Minnesota as people that have greed. Not in this committee. I won't allow that. So to go into my concerns about the bill, let's talk about affordability. Why we're at this point, why we have a bill with rent control in front of us. The picture in the state of Minnesota is we are the fifth highest tax state in the nation. Those costs trickle down all around us to the manufactured home park providers, to the contractors to do the work, to the people who are going to pay their mortgages and pay for their jobs, every single part of our lives. Mandates have been passed in the state of Minnesota that have increased our energy rates from the seventh most affordable to some of the most expensive in the state of Minnesota. That is the thing that's staring us in the face, and that's why we're here today. So to take a totally unproven method of rent control and say, here's the solution, is not fair to the people of Minnesota. It is not fair to the people that are in this situation. The way to help people right now is mandate relief, is tax relief, and is getting the burden off Minnesota taxpayers, because it's affecting every part of their daily lives. That is the problem. So when you take a step back and you look at the situation that's really dealing with in front of us, it's not greed. If there's greed happening in the state of Minnesota, it's by the taxing state of Minnesota. And we need to get that back on track, and that's how we return affordability to the state of Minnesota. This is an easy no vote.
I'll go to you, Representative Norris, for the comments. But I will say, I did not hear Representative Norris impugn motives of any particular owner. It's just a fact, especially when you look at the private equity, the out-of-state faceless hedge funds that have an outsized influence in this market, that greed is absolutely a motivation of those entities. And that's not imputing any motives of any individual business owner. It's just a matter of fact. But I want to go to Representative Norris to closing. But what I would say is I wanted to comment specifically on the opportunity to purchase piece of this, which I think is a really important part of this bill, in part because of that power imbalance. And in so many aspects of our economy, these out-of-state private equity billion-trillion-dollar behemoths are taking more control, as folks have referenced, the sort of power imbalance that exists. And your effort is about providing a little bit more power with the people, with Minnesotans, to set their own destiny. And an opportunity to purchase, as one of your testifiers mentioned, is about giving a little bit more of that control back to regular folks. And so I do appreciate your bill. I support it, and I'll go to you for any final comments.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And I'll first address Chair Igo's comments before moving into my closing comments. First, to the argument that we need to just tax cut and regulation cut our way out of this problem. There's no guarantee that those tax cuts, any cost saved by reduced regulation, is going to get passed on to the residents in the form of lower lot rents. Instead, it might just increase that margin that's already pretty darn healthy. And to the greed comment, Chair Howard addressed it very well. There are a lot of owners who are trying to do right by their residents, and I applaud those owners. And they should have nothing to worry about under this bill, because what this bill targets is situations like this one. Haven Park owned Park, a private equity firm in Brandondale in Chaska. Between 1994 and 2021, that's 27 years, the lot rent increased $186 over 27 years. That's 72% over a 27-year period. In just 4 years since the private equity firm bought the park, the lot rent increased 63%. So I'll let the public judge what's going on there. You don't have to take my word for it. Look at the facts. So now, members, I'll move to my closing comments. This is the third time we've brought this bill to the Housing Committee. And I was hopeful that this time was going to be different. And we'll find out in a minute if it is. But if it isn't, we're not going away. We'll keep working at it this year to get this passed. We'll be back next year if we need to. We'll be at it as long as it takes to make sure that so our neighbors in manufactured housing have what they need to keep their homes. But here's the problem. Every day that we wait, every year that we wait, more of these residents are at risk of losing their homes. There's a lot of manufactured housing residents in this room right now. Some of them might be the ones who lose their homes if we have to wait another year. And so, members, it's a time for choosing. Who are we with? Are we with our neighbors, or are we with the out-of-state private equity firms? Thank you, Chair Howard.
With that, we'll go to vote.
Co-Chair Howard?
Aye.
Howard votes aye. Co-Chair Igo?
Nay.
Igo votes nay. Vice Co-Chair Kozlowski.
Aye.
Kozlowski votes aye. Vice Co-Chair Dotseth.
Nay.
Dotseth votes nay. Representative Buck.
Huh, yay.
Buck votes aye. Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Hussein votes aye. Representative Johnson. Representative Meckland. Meckland votes nay. Representative Momani Hiltzley.
Momani Hiltzley, aye.
Momani Hiltzley votes aye. Representative Myers. Myers votes nay. Representative Nash.
No.
Nash votes nay. Representative Norris.
Aye.
Norris votes aye. Representative Rayrauer.
Aye.
Rayrauer votes aye. Representative Scraba.
Nay.
Scraba votes nay. Representative Johnson.
With 7 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representative Norris. Members, that concludes our business today. We are adjourned.